Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Happy Mama Movement podcast. I'm Amy Taylor Cabaz, mama, journalist, coach, and founder of Mama Rising. This podcast is a space of community and collaboration. We gather stories of matrescence, motherhood, womanhood, and change told by our Mama Rising coaches and mothers around the globe, in the knowing that through our stories, we can begin to heal and change the way the world sees, values, and supports mothers everywhere. So, welcome to the Happy Mama Movement. Welcome back, mamas. I have to admit that there are times over the last 15 years of wondering what impact all of this is having. There are times where I wonder if matrescence really will have the impact I believe, and so many of us believe it will. I see how many mums are still burnt out and even more burnt out post-COVID. And I try and remind myself that we are part of this huge change. Even if we don't see this change fully in our lifetime, we are part of it through these conversations. And then I speak to somebody like Sarah Cleggett. Sarah is the woman you're about to meet in this interview. She first enrolled in the very first incarnation of Mama Rising in 2019, when it was a six-week, I think, program around understanding matrescence. It wasn't certified. It didn't have coaching skills elements. It was just the beginning of this experience for me. And Sarah was there. She then went on to repeat the training as it changed two more times. And only recently did I discover that she then went on to study a master's in university on bringing matrescence into public policy in Australia. It's moments like this that I am reminded that we are making a difference, that these conversations are happening in small pockets all around the world. And so if you're downhearted today, feeling overwhelmed, wondering when things will change, I hope you hear this interview with Sarah and realize that it is changing and it's coming. So let me tell you a little about Sarah. She is a mother of two boys and, like I said, did Mama Rising three times over the last 6 years. She's also a social worker and began in drug and alcohol services and psychiatric inpatient environments. And I remember when I first met her, even in Mama Rising, was always about giving back, changing the system, and supporting those who can't support themselves, I guess is one way to say it. She has a double degree in social work and social planning and, like I said, just completed her master's of politics and policy. And she's also the founder of Middle Ground Motherhood in South Australia, which is a social enterprise and organisation that supports mothers through women's circles and matrescence education. She truly is one of the ones out there making a real change in matrescence and motherhood. And I'm so proud to share her story with you. Sarah, it is so good to see you again. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Amy. I'm so excited to be speaking to you.
It's so exciting because the conversation we're about to have is such a beautiful example of what matrescence and motherhood does. It begins with questions and then it takes the path of seeking answers And then it activates us to make sure that we do it differently, which I think is a great summary of what I understand your story to be. So let's start at the beginning then, when you became a mother and how this began inside of you, this experience of matrescence and these questions that you had.
Yeah, it feels like a long time ago now, 8 years ago, my first son was born. And not long after that, I came upon your work. And that's when I understood or began to understand what matrescence was, but I didn't come to that understanding until I had been through it myself. So mm-hmm. I had been someone who, I guess, strived in a traditional sense in terms of going to university and then working full-time in a job that I always wanted to do and really loved. And then I had my first son, and a friend told me, I said that I would take 6 months away from paid work when I had a child, that I would get straight back into it. Actually, I took 2 years away from paid work and really immersed myself in that experience, in part because I wanted to, in part because I felt I had to. So my husband was traveling regularly for work. I was doing a lot of the parenting by myself when he was away. And I don't know, there was a massive transformation. So I think anyone who's had a baby knows that that's the case. And the way that I thought that would look was completely different. And it also, you know, brought up a lot of things in me around the way that I had been mothered, around my mother's story of mm-hmm. being mothered. And I think I needed more time than I had anticipated to be able to make sense of all of that. And fortunately, I was in a position to take time away from paid work to immerse myself in that. And that's when I first did mama rising, I think.
So what was that like in those moments to decide you had that intention of only 6 months and then you ended up taking 2 years? Was that something you were okay with, or was that a struggle to realize I'm actually not ready, I need to be here, both for reasons because your husband was traveling, but also for you yourself?
I think I couldn't really make sense of any of it until I've been away from it, in a way. Like I think now I've had a second child, I've returned to work after having another 2 years with him, I've done a lot of study and self-reflection, and it's only really now that I can make sense of that time. I think at the time I was struggling a lot with what it meant not to be contributing to the household in a financial sense, and what that meant for my independence, for my sense of self-worth, for what I had, in Mama Rising terms, constructed a successful woman to look like. And I wasn't achieving on that front in the way that I had previously. So, you know, and I also had to unpack a lot around what a good mother was. And that's ongoing. ongoing.
Yeah, that one never ends. I'm glad you mentioned that financial definition of success, because over the years I've heard so many mothers, like you just did, say, I'm incredibly lucky and grateful that I could step back for 2 years. We almost want to say to the world, I know how privileged I am to have that experience and thank you. Mm-hmm. But also there's this feeling inside of this huge change of independence. And it's important for us to acknowledge that even though you could step back, it still meant a lot to you. It still meant a lot to know that you weren't financially contributing. I wonder if you've thought much about what that process was like.
I've thought a huge amount about it, yeah. Especially since having done my studies and unpacking what that means, both in the short term and the long term for women's lives. And I knew it then, but I know it now, and I still grapple with it. So, you know, from the perspective of my superannuation contributions, obviously stepping away from work for that amount of time is a huge amount of time. I wasn't contributing to my superannuation, and I know what that means at the other end. There's about $100,000 gap between men and women's superannuation come retirement, and Oh, I knew that to be the case and I still needed the time.
Yeah.
And in terms of returning part-time as well, like in a logical sense, I know what all of that means.
Mm.
And I know that making those decisions means in the longer term I'm going to be less financially well off. And I didn't know how else to do it to make it okay to do the parenting and look after myself in the way that I needed to. And I think that led me down the path of saying, why am I having to take this hit as an individual? Because I want to mother in a certain way and I want to look after myself in a certain way. And where's all the support that's meant to exist for us to have choices around this? Like I have real choices that don't have, can have quite dire consequences in the long term. And so I think that's when I started to really think about, you know, what mother-centered public policy would look like so that, I mean, in matricentric feminist terms, we talk about empowered motherhood, and empowered motherhood is giving you choices about how you mother.
Yeah.
And I had some of those choices because of the particular workplace I was in that I did get paid parental leave. And I had choices because of, you know, some of the savings I was able to amass before I became a mother, and I had choices because I was in a relationship with someone who was, and still am, with someone who is also earning money. And I think that all of those individual circumstances should not dictate the flexibility that women have about making choices of how they mother. I think some of that should exist at a state level so everybody has that choice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting the way that you just, you know, importantly pointed out the things that you did have access to that a lot of women don't. And yet even with those things, you will still end up financially disadvantaged. You will still not be able to, well, the statistics show you won't get to the career level you would have. Like the statistics are still there, even though you see that you have more privilege than others. So on every single level, it's not working.
No. And the motherhood penalty affects all mothers. But if you apply an intersectional lens, then if you're a mother who's a single mother, if you're a mother who's culturally and linguistically diverse, if you're a queer mother, like any of those other intersections, if that's happening for you, then these decisions only get harder and your oppression is more compounded. So, yeah, I acknowledge my privilege because compared to some of the other intersections that women and others find themselves in, I am advantaged. But compared to my male counterparts, you know, they're experiencing the fatherhood bonus. And, you know, we talk about the gender pay gap and the motherhood penalty accounts for so much of that.
So can you explain for everyone who hasn't heard before, I'm sure everybody on this podcast knows about the motherhood penalty, what is the fatherhood bonus?
Well, in the way that we are disadvantaged by motherhood in time taken out of work, in having less access to educational opportunities in our childbearing years, in having less access to income, the stats show that men who become fathers, generally speaking, are unaffected, and in some cases, a fair few cases, are able to progress as if they don't have children because, generally speaking, they have a partner who's female who's taking on the vast majority of that unpaid care. And that is the case in my relationship, that my husband was able to continue on in his career trajectory as he always had. He took a new job, he was traveling, because I enabled that. And that's changed a little bit as we've progressed in our parenting. But I can't ever make up the time that I took out. And I think there's a sense still, if people were to look at my resume, that they would see that 4 years that I was out of paid work and not be able to resolve that in terms of maybe looking at a male counterpart who didn't have that 4 years out of work. And so that's the fatherhood bonus. That's like, you know, having the person that holds it up for you. And also I think there's a view within that literature that if you're a father, you're more reliable, you know, you're more ambitious, you're taking up that breadwinner role and you're really committed to the work, whereas mothers are seen as less reliable, less committed to the work. you know, less ambitious, which is not true. It just looks different.
Yes. I'm sure, as you said, the literature and statistics shows this. I'm sure if you compared a reliable family man to a single gay man, he would argue too that there is this, you know, cultural assumption that that is somebody who's here to dedicate themselves to being the breadwinner. Like, there's so many different layers of this. Mm. In a moment, we will talk about public policy and what you've done since all of this has been awakened in you. But I would love to take a moment and talk about what it's been like for you to dive into all of this research and study and see this yourself now personally.
Mm.
What it's like to begin to see the systematic process that we're in, how we treat fathers and mothers and how we do this for yourself first. Was there like anger and grief? Did it? How has that played out for you personally?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I spent, you know, most of last year really deep in this literature and the stats for my thesis. And I think now I've been out of it a while, I realize the impact that that had on me, the impact that living this experience while studying it, while being immersed in it, is really taxing, actually.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that anyone who's an activist would understand, because generally we're advocating for things that, you know, affect our lives.
Yeah.
And to be doing the advocacy and the activism while you're living it actually takes a fairly large toll, I think, and I know through my experience. And so there's a lot of support that needs to go in around me for me to be able to do this work, and it's still really taxing. But once you see, you can't unsee. And so it doesn't feel like a choice. Like, I can't turn away from this work now, even though I sometimes feel like I would like to. That doesn't feel like it's a choice I can make.
I remember having a conversation with Dr. Aurelie Athan, who, for those who are new here, is really, I call her the godmother of matrescence. She really is the lead researcher in the world at the moment around matrescence. And when I was working with her one-on-one, I felt the same, Sarah, and I remember talking to her about it. And my homework, the paper, the research she asked me to then focus on, was looking at activism fatigue in a lot of the movements in our history who have made great changes, and how these people that are on the ground making the changes or advocating for the changes while still living the system themselves kept going. Mm. Because it is a really big challenge to show up for something so huge like you are and like I feel I am too, when we are also still just trying to do this ourselves. How have you come to terms with that? How have you kept going?
Mm. Oh, it's such a big question.
And if you have the answer, let me know, because I still working through that myself.
I mean, it's super tricky because I think one of the things that we've lost in a neoliberal society, and one that doesn't perhaps value public service and thought leadership in the way that some other countries do, is that it's very hard to make a living doing this work, but I still need to make a living. And so trying to find meaningful, you know, paid work alongside some of the paid work that I do, obviously, with my social enterprise, but some of this work is unpaid. Like, you know, there's a large percentage that's unpaid, as you know, and as you're building the momentum as well, you know, you don't necessarily have the people contributing to your movement until you get to a tipping point where they're like, yes, I'm on board. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I have fully resolved it. I'm just trying to show up authentically in all the spaces that I'm in, I guess. And actually, that's not always easy. But the way that I do that is by coming back to my why all the time. And, you know, what can I live with and what can't I live with? And I can't live without feeling as if I'm contributing to this work. And the way that I'm sustained in terms of doing it is by sitting in circle. I facilitate women's circles and I attend women's circles.
Mm-hmm.
I have therapy. I read a lot. I have a really supportive partner. I focus in on the joy that my children bring and the mayhem. And, I think there's a lot of grounding that has to go on in order to sustain the work. And I have to get better at checking in with myself about whether I'm reaching my limit before I've tipped over. And I think I started to reach that limit last year when I was very immersed in the study and the work. And I've had to reassess, the whole spiral. I refer to that all the time. Like it's like, hello, we're back here again, are we?
Wait. I swear we should mark all the mummerizing, but, we should have our little, it's just a spiral. Thank you for your honesty with that. It's another part I don't think we talk that much about when something is activated in you to do something to change and yet you are still a part of the system that is struggling so much and what that feels like. And also that anger and sadness that can sometimes come when that veil is lifted. I've heard so many times over the years in Mama Rising, in the training, women saying, oh, I am just so angry all of a sudden. I can't stop telling my partner or husband, why does it have to be me? You should be. And it's part of the process, I think, though, Sarah, is this, if we want to change it, we have to see it for what it is, move through our own emotions around it, and then as much as we can support ourselves to get into action. And so I'm really grateful that you were honest about what that's been like for you.
Mm. Yeah, and ongoing, like it's an ongoing kind of dance around how to make it work. And like you say, that anger that I think comes in and out as you're doing the work and as you're renegotiating the relationships in your life and what they look like, your relationship to your partner, if you have one, if they're male, to your children, to your friends, to your family, to your paid work life. I think it's difficult, but I've found that it's worth it. The relationship that I'm in now with my partner compared to what it was before, we're in completely different people, really, and luckily we've been able to negotiate that together. I don't think that's always possible. And in work life and with friendships and things, like, I'm not the same person I was before I became a mother. Probably after I had my first child, I'm not the same person as I was. I don't know. It's so huge, like this transition and the fact that there's so many people who don't even acknowledge it, who don't even talk about it, still blows my mind all the time.
It blows, I know. And I would argue you're not the same person after you started studying this either. So like motherhood is its own initiation, and then once you start going into understanding how did we get here, that's its own initiation. One of the things that I've struggled with so much over the last 15 years of being in this space that I know that you are equally, if not even more passionate about, is I would frame it this way. How do we ask the women, the mamas who are most affected by this, to pay for this so we can keep doing this work? I know you and I have had a few chats over the years. So you started the Mama Rising training like way back before it was even a fully accredited training. Yeah. And I know that was it's something that comes up a lot in our space, doesn't it? That to do this work, we want to talk to the mamas, but how can we ask them to find the money or to do this that they may not have themselves, which is why you've moved into more of the public policy space and to have a look at that state support. But can you talk us through your feelings around that and where you've landed?
I think there's a couple of different bits. One is that I think there should be more state support to support women to do this. So in terms of postpartum support, there's none. So, what would it be like if, like some of the other systems that exist, like Medicare or NDIS or you know, whatever it might be, that there's a pool of money that's allocated to a woman that is around how she supports herself during her matrescence, and it's for her to decide how that money is spent. And there are models like that around the world where the money is allocated to the woman and she then, you know, distributes that as she sees fit, which is different to what happens in Australia, where mostly that money goes to healthcare providers. In Australia, that's mostly obstetricians who are making a lot of money from our experience. You know, what would it look like if we took that money back and we had a choice about remaking those systems in the ways that we wanted them to look? So there's that. And then there's also the bit that, you know, we've talked about, which is I have to value this work first and foremost. Like, and I think that's something that I have to round back to a lot, which is, you know, I've been asked to reduce fees and things like that with my circles. And in some instances, absolutely, I have done that. And in other instances, I've held really strong to saying, I'm charging for this work because it's valuable and you have to value it. Why? Like, would you ask your mechanic for a discount? Would you ask your electrician? Would you ask your plumber? No, you would not. Mm-hmm. So the internalized, probably what I would call misogyny that exists in all of us, we do it to each other and we do it to ourselves. And so why are you asking me for a discount on this work? Do you not value it?
Mm-hmm.
In the sense, do you not value what I'm contributing here, or do you not value the time that it will require you to dedicate to it? And I think both of those things are at play when that question comes up. Also, I recognise there's a gender pay gap and a motherhood penalty. And, you know, trying to sell something to a cohort of women who are at the most financially vulnerable they've ever been, you know, is not a great business proposition, to be honest. So, you know, like there's a few different levers that need to be pulled. Yeah,
which is why we need to look at different areas of funding, social impact funding, grants, government, state support, etc. I would argue with the way that you beautifully just described that, you know, not only do we need to say you have to value me in what I'm giving you here, you wouldn't ask your mechanic or your GP for a discount, and she needs to value what she's getting out of it, but it also comes into that huge just we don't value motherhood space.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember when I first started years ago, if I could say that my programs helped you be a better mother, you know, I wouldn't have said it that, you know, that black and white, but if I could put it through the lens of you won't yell as much, you will be calmer, it's about the impact on the children, then she'll find the money for it. But if it's just about her and her self-care and her self-reflection and her self-growth, she can't justify that cost. Mm-hmm. And then that leads us directly back into the overall problem, which is motherhood is invisible and not supported, and just assume that we know how to do this and we'll just get on with it.
Yeah.
So what, after you've just finished your master's, which is phenomenal, so share with us what your thesis actually was. What did you contribute to this space?
Well, I mean, it feels like a mouthful, but the piece I've called Mums in Public, The Value of Mother-Centered Public Policy, and it was about looking through the lens of matrescence at public policy in Australia specifically, and what it would look like to design public policy with mothers in mind, you know, with mothers as a central decision-making point. Because I think increasingly there's more of a focus on child-friendly, you know, policy and outcomes, but still not much recognition that a child's outcomes really hinge on how the mum's doing. Why aren't we speaking in those terms is always a question I keep coming back to. Even, you know, in some of the policy pieces in the state I live in, South Australia, and also at a federal level, we're not necessarily speaking about that motherhood experience. We're speaking about, yes, the motherhood penalty is certainly being discussed more, and I appreciate seeing that. But the whole trajectory of motherhood, that whole process, I think we're still not speaking about it in the way that recognizes just how profound it is and how much mothers and caregivers, but particularly mothers, contribute to our society in an economic sense, because that's how, you know, we have to frame everything, but more broadly in a well-being sense, in a emotional well-being, like all of the ways that mothers are holding things together in communities, in their families, and what happens when they can't do that anymore, which I think we've seen post-COVID with a lot of really burnt out mothers who aren't actually allowed to say they're burnt out, but are. They've really hit the wall and they're still trying to manage, you know, paid work, children, all of the extracurricular things in workplaces that increasingly have gone back to saying you have to be in the office, otherwise your contribution is not valued. And, you know, flexible work, sure, but this is what leadership looks like here and you have to do it this way, otherwise you don't have access to it.
Oh, that is the best way I've ever heard that described. Flexible workplaces, yeah, absolutely, we do that, but this is what leadership looks like, and if you want to have access to that, this is what we expect from you. So have you got any hope or answers or solutions for us?
Yeah, I have hope, for sure I have hope. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I examined in my thesis was the four-day work week. And I think that, you know, there was a time in Australia where we could have never imagined the 40-hour work week or 37.5 hours, because it just seemed impossible, you know, when people were working 7 days a week. But then a union movement came together, a collective movement came together and said, we're not doing this anymore. It's not working. You know, we're not productive. We're making mistakes. You know, we're dying in accidents, things like that. You know, we want to have more balance. And so it shifted. But, it, you know, 40 years on, we're not revisiting what a standard work week is, but we could be. And the Working Care Inquiry, Senate Inquiry, recommended that we do. And there's been a lot of examples around the world of four-day work week trials, which is that you do all of the work of a full-time role but in 4 days. So you're still receiving the same amount of pay, but within 4 days. And mostly that benefits, you know, mothers. It benefits everyone. But, you know, if I go part-time now, I get a part-time wage, and I'm seen as contributing less. Whereas if there was a whole workplace culture of 4 days, the standard starts to look different. And so I think these things are entirely possible. You know, and things like universal early childhood education and care, we're moving toward those kind of policy changes now, thanks to the advocacy of a huge amount of people. And things like the activity test for childcare, you know, we're moving toward that being abolished, because it says that the only way you can get care support is if you're making a paid work contribution. Well, what about all the care? So, you know, the way that we're valuing things, we can be remaking how we talk about gross domestic product, GDP, in this country, to include care. You know, we count almond milk, we count cow's milk, we count soy milk, we don't count breast milk. So there are countries that do, Norway does. So we could be thinking about these ways of putting together the ledger that actually recognise all of this work that it goes unrecognised at the moment.
And the exciting thing about that is that through those changes, we're also opening up to all the other ways that we care beyond just motherhood. You know, we also then have when our parents are sick, when our partner is unwell, when our animal is unwell. But you've heard me say this so many times over the last 5 years, but, you know, matrescence has the power to change the world. Because of this, I think, it brings all of those invisible parts of us into the workplace and into public policy. You know, we start with motherhood, but look what else, and who else would benefit from this? The potential is world-changing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We're up against it. Like, there's a lot of interests that don't want to see this change, I think. It feels impossible to them, which is why we need the movement. We need the movement. We need people to awaken to the fact that this is not okay. Like, we know it's not okay. We need to be able to name it. That's the benefit of having the word matrescence. And then together imagine a different way forward. We have to have collective action. It's not going to occur without it. And that's why, you know, I started Middle Ground Motherhood, why you started Mum Rising, why all of these collectives, I think, need to come together to be pushing this narrative that says, we know this isn't working. Like, we're speaking regularly to mothers who say, I'm on the brink here. Like, I cannot do this. I don't know the way forward. I'm falling to bits. And the system is inflexible. So somehow we have to bring those things together to be able to advocate for a different way forward.
Which is so mind-blowing that that's what you've just done with this thesis and with this master's, that you took that experience and are now doing this work. And I think for all of the mamas listening, whether you are building a business in this or you're a mama at home with a couple of kids and trying to balance it all, I hope you feel that you're part of this movement, that it is every single one of us in the smallest and big ways starting to say to each other, to our boss, to our next door neighbours, about this need for change. This is how it will come from the mothers. It will come from the groundswell, won't it, Sarah?
100%. It's the ripples. And I did your course, what, 7 years ago? You know, and then I did it again. And then I did it again. But that's what it takes, because you do it and you know it to be true, and then you go back into a world that doesn't value what you're doing as a mother. And you're like, oh, well, maybe I was wrong about that. So you do it again. You're like, no, I wasn't wrong. And then you have another baby and you're even deeper in it. And it's like, wow, you know, this needs to change.
It needs to change. And thank you for being a part of that in such a proactive, profound way. It's absolutely amazing. And Sarah, we'll pop the details into the show notes for people to see what you're doing and find out more if they are interested. Thank you for your advocacy. And also thank you for being so honest about what that feels like to carry that desire to change this while also living that. I think we all need to be reminded of how heavy that is, but we are together in this movement.
Absolutely. Together we can do it.
Together we can do it. Thank you so much, beautiful. Thanks, as always, for being a part of our global matrescence community. Please take a moment and make sure you're subscribed to this podcast in your podcast player so you can always be notified of our next episode. And if you would like to work with a coach on your own experience of matrescence, please go to mamarising.net and explore our directory of phenomenal coaches, workshop leaders, space holders and facilitators around the globe. You can also explore our Global Matrescence Foundation and consider donating so a mama in need can access the support of one of our coaches and still ensure that our coaches receive the income and support they need so they can continue to work in this way. And finally, if you would like to be a coach, a facilitator, and a matrescence activist in your own community, jump on our wait list for our next intake of the Mama Rising Facilitator Training at mamarising.net. Thank you for being here and being part of this movement. Until next week, bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.